budget media lockup in Canberra at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, both on 2SER and over the Community Radio Network. Tune in then.
The defence, which has been on the rise and has cost Australians a much
bigger Rather than just thinking about it, we do it.
I've been stopped on the street and spat on.
How many pages do I have to do and how much have I done so far? I've only done like 1%.
And bang, within like a split second, I had no time to react, I was on the ground.
Because the reason why this is even occurring is because there's a demand.
Welcome to Razor's Edge. You're on 2SER 107.3 with me, Jesse Begley. This week, we are Sydney's own New South Wales-focused current affairs program. We have four stories covering the most relevant and upcoming news made for the local audiences of Sydney. From Bondi, Hornsby to Sutherland, our producers are out and about covering stories from your local area. This week, we look at the opening of a new creative hub in Parramatta and other spaces of invest to their own space and business. We look at the risk of a new city to self-care. What does your suburb say about your health? Razor's Edge chats with the Executive Director of the SAGE organisation on the definition of intersectionality and initiatives to improve standards for women in STEM industries. We hear from the OzHarvest's New South Wales State Manager, Alicia Kinwabout, about these new produce waste and get food in the hands of customers at a price they can afford. You're listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. And so we go to our first story now. Inspired by the creative hubs and the makerspace movements, there are several studios and artists-run initiatives popping up all over the arterial links and western areas of Sydney. In Parramatta in particular, it's a geographical epicentre of our city, and then blending this with the diverse communities, we are looking forward to the way artistic and designer market community is going to look like. Sharing spaces, collaborating for an artistic ecosystem, and this exchange community does resemble the kinds of the San Fran tech startups the Melbourne and Sydney are taking to the concept model and trying to find out more about this. We chat with founders Anna Glumbertelson and Jean-Luc Batchelor of their respective creative spaces. What inspired you to start this project and start it in Parramatta?
The inspiration for creating this space came from initially from seeing other similar spaces such as, I think it was called Higher Ground Studios in Lidcombe, I believe. It's where some street artists such as Deist Man, Sids, and a couple of other guys had a studio. And I went there on Open Studio Trail years ago and just was like, yes, this is what I want. This is what I want to make. And what brought me to Parramatta is I'm from the local Parramatta area, and I wanted to bring this kind of makerspacey artist studio community hub style vibe to Parramatta.
What kind of people are you working with, you know, at the creative hub?
At the moment, we have a couple of like street arty kind of artists coming through, some artists in more of a membership based system who, you know, come and rather than renting their own studio space, pay a membership fee and use the communal area and out the back for some larger projects or smaller projects or whatever they're really working on at the time. So a mixed variety of artistic people and just people who are artistically inclined in some way. I set it up so that instead of needing to, you know, apply for a 6-month period like you do at the government-run ones around the place, if you want, you can just come in, see if you like the place, pay whatever fee suits whatever you want to do, and just use it for as long as you want, not have to be in there for necessarily 6 months, then you're kicked out or, you know, anything like that. It's more of a flexible or longer-term model, depending on what you want.
Yeah, it's great to see this new trend with, and you see so many small businesses sharing office blocks with each other. I rent a space myself, you know, and I share it with, you know, what, five other businesses. And it must be great to have artists to be able to have a space for a reasonable price. They don't have to hire out their whole studio.
It's flexible enough that if you had, like, you know, a couple of other people who you wanted to share a space with, you could split it up between, you know, or you could pay, again, you know, a lower amount and do the whole kind of share, hot desky style thing, but we don't really have the, you know, actual desks of that normal arrangement.
Yeah, absolutely. And what do you think this is going to do for that local environment in Parramatta where you've set up the show?
I'm hoping that it will further the, you know, creative capacity of Parramatta and provide people, I guess, just a place to come and make things.
This is Anna Glumbertelson, director of the Sifters Business Co-op in Wollongong that hosts six businesses under one roof.
Everyone's been, overwhelmingly positive. I mean, we've had not that many people leave, actually. Like, we've had a couple of people that have gone on to do other things and had to move away for other reasons or, you know, have wanted to do their own project. But mostly it's been really good. We've had people there almost since the start who basically have had the opportunity to start their own business but without sort of all the overheads, and basically you sort of sharing the risk and sharing the kind of burden, and it kind of obviously you're maybe getting less of a kind of return because you're sort of sharing the space and the capital that you get, but it's also way less responsibility, way less stress. And then, way less sort of startup costs, I guess, by doing that. And it's definitely, taken a lot of the risk off us and basically means people can help pay the rent every week. So it's good.
Absolutely. And do you think, I mean, this business co-op that you guys are running, is that a model you think for the future for small businesses to start up?
I would definitely recommend it. I mean, it depends sort of what you want, but we're happy to relinquish a little bit of the control. And obviously it's really good as well for people who are specialised in a certain industry to do what they do best. So I'm not the best off, so I don't really necessarily want to run a cafe. I'd rather have the space there and be able to work with the people that do know how to run a cafe to make it kind of be as good as it can be or whatever, or help them. I don't know how to run a florist. So, the woman that runs the florist at Sifters is amazing. She does her job amazingly. She brings people to the co-op and, you know, we work alongside her, facilitate that. So it's kind of everyone does what they're good at and you kind of share the load and work together, and I would definitely recommend it as a model for the future.
All right, and thanks again to Anna Glumbertelson from Sifters and Jean-Lou Batchelor from Alt Art Link Studios out of Parramatta. You can look at their website at makerspace.org, find the movement. You're listening to Razor's Edge live on 107.3 FM and streaming online at 2SER.com. Don't go anywhere, because up next is your suburb fat or not? A discussion on the newest findings of the health tracker coming up. You're on 2SER 107.
Days, year for out.
2SER will be live on the ground in Canberra May 9 and 10 with artists and experts ready to bring you in-depth analysis and commentary on the coalition plans for the nation over the next 4 years.
Who will be the winners? Who will miss out at that deficit?
Tune in May 9th and 10th to get 2SER's independent coverage of the budget.
Everything you need to know right here on 2SER 107.3.
You're back with me, Jesse Begley, on Razor's Edge. Our next story. With chronic illness and obesity on the rise, there have been many desperate attempts to identify and resolve the situation. With a new health tracker fact sheet highlighting Australian suburbs with the highest rates of obesity, among other things, is this solution that we've been waiting for, or is it going to cause more harm than good? This is Lisa Hand with the story.
According to an updated health tracker, there is now geographical proof that the health of children can be tied to wealth and where they live. Based on a compilation of national data, the health tracker aims to paint a picture of the rising tide of chronic illness in Australia. We spoke to Professor Rosemary Calder, the Director of Australian Health Policy Collaboration, about the key findings.
What's very telling in bringing the data together like this is how much your wealth or your disposable income affects your ability to make choices that can improve your health and in Sydney, as with every other major city in Australia, the suburbs that are known as more affluent or more leafy are the suburbs where there are higher rates of physical activity than in other suburbs, and particularly the ones we now know as commuter suburbs, where there's very little opportunity to walk.
The health checker finds that suburbs like Mount Druitt and Silverwater have the highest rates of obese and overweight children. This is compared to affluent suburbs like Mossman and Pymble, who experience the lowest rates. Professor Louise Hardy from the Charles Perkins with the health checker.
So the health tracker hitting the mark. It is fat shaming various people, and that is wrong. It is focused. We all know that overweight and obesity is unevenly distributed across our communities, and that people in low socioeconomic groups have a greater risk of being overweight and obese. That is a well-established fact. So by having a health tracker that allows the community to plug in their postcode and see if they live in a fat suburb is not contributing to solving the problem at all. If anything, it's just increasing the disparities between the rich and the poor.
Instead, she believes there should be a greater focus on identifying the causes of childhood obesity.
Ideally, what that tracker should be doing is allowing people to look at the behaviours that contribute to overweight and obesity. So looking at what are the physical activity levels, consumptions of processed food, high screen time, there's a range of behaviours that contribute. And it is not the people, it is the environment. They're the things that we need to be focusing on, not saying these people in this suburb are fat.
Where one in four children are identified as overweight or obese, Professor Hardy had serious concerns for the future health implications of Australia.
All right, so for children, we need to encourage them from a very early age to engage in a range of health behaviours. So that's the physical activity of good sleep and screen time hygiene. Without that, children are set up for developing osteoporosis. They're on the risk, increased risk of acquiring type 2 diabetes, which is traditionally an adult disease. And I think kind of for children, the most immediate consequence of childhood obesity is bullying and teasing.
Professor, systems and parks in less affluent suburbs, which is a significant factor in higher obesity rates.
The western suburbs, they're pretty strongly characterised by fewer trees in their communities, fewer parks, much less amenity in terms of walking trails and bike trails than the leafy coastal suburbs. Where you live provides you with a wealthy or less wealthy environment which affects your choices. We're expecting people to look after themselves in an environment that has taken away the opportunity to do that.
Instead, she recommends that Sydney suburbs bridge the gap in obesity by providing greater opportunities for a healthy lifestyle.
It's a multinational issue, multi-level of government issue, and that includes opportunities for local governments to change their environments, but local governments, particularly low-income local governments, would need the support of state and federal governments, and it would need an investment of money. But that's an investment that would reap huge benefits in decades to come, because we'd be creating a healthier population by improving physical activity levels at all ages.
This was Lena Han for Razor's Edge.
And thank you to Professor Kalger and Professor Hardy for their contribution to this story. We're going to go to next. We hear from the Executive Director, Wafa El Adage Organisation, to give us information on their new pilot program.
So maybe put on hold. Sometimes my heart may seem awful cold. These times come and these times go. As long as I live, all you need to know is so dark, ain't about to forget all we've had on its next. Long as my heart's beating in my chest, this old dog ain't about to forget. Often a heart tends to change its mind. New day decides on a new design. A new day gets set on another way. As long as I live, all I've got day is, this old dog ain't about to forget all we've had and all that's next. Long as my heart's beating in my head, so about forget.
All right, now you're back on Razor's Edge. This Old Dog by Mac DeMarco off our album of the week here at 2SER, also entitled This Old Dog. We go to our next story. Now, the research and the development industries, such as science, technology, engineering and mathematics, STEM for short, has reported in dropping percentages in the retention of female delegates in all sphere. The investment shown by the government and the subsidies, like SAGE, has identified for further and the implementation of programs for improving workplace environments for female executives, scientists and engineers. Aside this, we have yet another layer to consider the definition of intersectionality. And what is it, you hear? Razor's Edge producer Hyo spoke to Wafa El Adami from the SAGE organisation to tell us a little bit about what intersectionality is.
We thought to first ask how you would define intersectionality.
So I think the term was coined quite a long time, if I can use the term long, the cringe we've learned on our SAGE journey. And when I actually speak about SAGE, I often refer to myself as an example of how it's simple defining intersectionality, which is a complex term. So I say I'm a Middle Eastern woman who had migrated to Australia. English is my second language. I have a science degree. In my family, there are probably now about five different nationalities represented. And I certainly migrated to Australia as a mature age person. So that brings the complexities of what makes me as a person. And in looking at trying to address issues of importance to women and other gender minorities or diverse cultures, it is important to really take into account the multi-factors that make us who we are in a particular setup or system. SAGE came to existence in 2015, formally was launched. The initiative is a pilot of Athena's One Charter, which is a framework to accredit and recognise achievement in gender equality and diversity that has been applied in the UK for over 10 years for the higher education and research sector. In essence, what the framework says, asks the universities and research institutes to commit to a set of 10 principles that speak largely to the importance of recognising the contributions of all individuals who participate in a system and acknowledge that there are barriers and issues that impact on their entry, retention and success, particularly speaking about women and minority genders and diverse cultures, but also talks about taking action to reverse those inequities. The SAGE pilot now has 40 members from the higher education and research sector. 30 of our universities, 6 medical research institutes, and 4 publicly funded research organizations, all have committed to the principles under the Athena Swan Charter, which means they will start on a journey of self and reflective analysis of their own organizations, looking at the elements of participation and success of women and other genders, as well as Indigenous people within their system. I don't have an answer of what is the time frame, but I know that the commitment and enthusiasm here in the sector are really strong. But I also know that there are complementing programs that are happening, such as the Male Champions of Change, which now actually applies into the STEM. So we have a number of our own organizations, members of SAGE. Their leaders are also members of the Male Champions of Change in STEM. So you've got an alignment of a number of initiatives at a national level that are certainly going to really drive improvement into the coming years. Australian government, under the National Innovation Science Agenda, has funded the Science in Australia Gender Equity Initiative with $2 million over 3 years to support its implementation. So there is strong commitment from that level, but also our own members commit their own funding to support SAGE and to support investment within their organisations to advance gender equity and diversity.
How do we identify that their situation is uniquely at a disadvantage?
So this is exactly where the 10 principles and the approach to Athena Swan within the pilot we're running really focuses attention on this. So often it is thought only about data, but it is not only about data. The first tier that analysis requires is really to look at quantitative data. What are they in terms of distribution of men and women, females and males, but also then the across the various disciplines, the pie. So numbers are only one dimension. And one. The next evidence that is important and that is required as part of the self-assessment by institutions is really to look at those qualitative dimensions, the dimensions of how do we know how our policies are affecting people, Indigenous people. So they have to demonstrate this evidence as part of their own assessment. Usually what institutes, there are a number of different approaches institutes can apply. An experience, for example, from the UK, but also here in Australia from some of the programs of change, an institute could actually look at the national data and the performance of other agencies or organisations within the sector, and they may choose to set their own targets within the system for their organisation. They choose to actually set percentages of improvements and strategies that will help them to get to there. They may decide on key performance indicators within a corporate structure that they have.
Thank you to Wafa El Adami, Executive Director of the SAGE organisation in Canberra, for speaking to us and helping us all understand what they're doing. Our next story is all about OzHarvest. They are rescuing food that would otherwise go to waste and making it available in the new market for exchange for an amount shoppers can afford. We hear from the OzHarvest New South Wales State Manager, Elisa Kerwin, to find out more about how Sydney is embracing this project and its impact on improving food security and fighting waste.
What was the most a red supermarket?
Yeah, look, we were very lucky to be gifted the space that we've moved into. It was an opportunity for us to then be using an underutilised area that we could turn into something that could have been a soup kitchen or, a drop-in centre, and we decided to try and do something that was a little bit more innovative. So, you know, I guess for us it's an opportunity to provide our food to people that find it otherwise hard to access. And having done so, it means that people can come in, they can see just how much food does go to waste, which is a third of everything that is produced globally. And we just ask them to come in and take just what they need and pay if they can. And so far, it's been an amazing response.
Well, it is a very, very nice innovation and a touching thing to see this sort of stuff happening. Now, with services like OzHarvest or even things like soup kitchens, it's one of the big questions has to be, how do you ensure that these services aren't exploited or misused by people who are more well off but are just looking for a free handout?
Yeah, sure. It's a great question. And I mean, to be honest, we have good faith that people come in and operate with dignity and integrity. And so far, we're finding that's exactly what's happening. So it's definitely a different experience to a conventional supermarket. When people enter the space, they're greeted by a volunteer, and the volunteers then walk through the experience with them. So rather than them coming in and shopping unaccompanied, the purpose of that is for them to engage with our volunteers, understand who OzHarvest is, why we exist, the issues around food waste, and understanding that our purpose is to nourish our country. When they come through, we make suggestions to them based on the types of products that we have in stock at the time, because they vary. Sometimes we might have 200 kilos of carrots, and then the next week we might have, you know, 50 kilos of peaches. So it always varies, and it means that we can make suggestions around the ways to best utilise the food and to minimise food waste with us on that journey. But it also means that we can ask questions about who they're shopping for today, what their current situation is, and how we can best help them. So it is a little bit different, and that does tend to create a lot more connection and community involvement. And for that reason, we find people are being really respectful of what we're doing.
Oh, yeah, it sounds like there's a big human element to it, which is very nice to hear. Now, can you tell me about involvement with big supermarket chains?
Yeah, so we collect from all the major supermarkets. We rescue food from them. You know, as they turn over and get new produce, we do so when they might have stock where competitions are ending and the labels are changing. We collect as well from producers, lots of different cafes, boardrooms, events, everywhere. We've got over 2,000 donors nationwide, and we service over 900 charities already that we take food to, agencies. So for that reason, we've had such a beautiful response and a lot of support from the supermarkets in running this and understanding why we're here.
Well, it's nice to hear the supermarkets being involved, you know, big supermarkets being involved in something like a positive drive. Like, it's going to be great for, I know, a lot of my student friends in times of real struggle have wound up dumpster diving outside of supermarkets. So it's good to have a safer and healthier outlet.
And thank you to Alicia Kerwin for speaking to us, and to Helen Henry for producing that piece. You're on 2SER 107.3.
In Trump's inaugural address, he promised to save America from crime and disorder.
This American carnage stops right here, right now.
Data editor of The Guardian US, Mona Chalabi, editor-in-chief of Slate, Julia Turner, lauded writer George Saunders, and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Colson Whitehead discussed Trump's progress at Sydney Writers Festival, May 26, Sydney Town Hall. Tickets on sale at swf.org.au. Sydney Writers Festival, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
I'm Jesse Begley, and a big thanks to our Razor's Edge producers for getting us these intriguing stories. Big Bronte Walker, Lisa Han, and Hyo-Jin Shim. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of Razor's Edge, 2SER's Sydney-focused current affairs program, which will time 30 on Thursdays. Same day, same time, with different stories. If you'd like to hear any story from tonight's program again, or indeed any story we've played, you can head over to our website and hear it there. Don't go anywhere, though, because Static is up next with 2 hours of awesome new music for you. To take us out, we have this old, My Old Man on our Mac.